You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you guys so much for downloading and listening. If you've been listening to and enjoying our little show, please consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. Folks, if you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you, that's it, $5 a month, and you want to see it continue to go and keep going strong, please consider becoming a patron of our show. You can go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island, sign up there, it's $5 a month. You'll get exclusive access to a live chat during the U.S. broadcast of each new episode of The Curse of Oak Island. I love that chat. You're going to love it, too. So, again, folks, go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island. It's $5 a month. You can cancel anytime. People have asked me about one-time donations. The only way you could do that for us is via Venmo. So you can make a one-time donation using my username at Dave McBride Music. And all those patron support and all of that, all of the donations I've gotten have helped to upgrade the equipment here, have managed to get me to carve out a little more time for things like research and the podcast. And there's expense to it, you know. So thank you guys so much. Everybody who has joined the Patreon, who's donated to the show, I really do appreciate it. All right. I actually have no emails to read for you this week. And you heard that right. An unprecedented turn of the events here at the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. But never fear. It is decidedly not because we didn't receive any emails, because in fact we did. However, most of them, or a lot of them, are about a subject that I think we're going to really tackle more and really in depth at the end of the season. And that's namely things like the sea levels around Oak Island and other sort of topics related to that. Got a few emails on that, and I just kind of want to hold on to them. There are other emails I got. There were two I want to mention. Steve and Rob, who both sent me what I would call some homework to do in the coming weeks. Videos to watch, articles to read, et cetera, et cetera. I just didn't have time to get to them this week, so we have to kind of wait for that stuff until after the season's over when I have some time to do it. Most of my time for the podcast this week is dedicated to research and going through the show. I watch the show two or three times. I take notes, write a script usually. Sometimes I have to kind of outline instead of script, but I wrote one this week, and this is a great example of that. I mean, we're out late, a couple of days later than I'd like to be out because there's just so much I had to get into here. So it's actually a good day to not have podcasts to read. But Rob and Steve, keep all that stuff in mind. Remind me when we get back to that subject after the season ends. And so we can, and all of you who wrote in about the sea levels, remind me about that. Whatever you had to say or that you sent an email, and we'll definitely get to it again. All right. So with that in mind, we're going to jump right into the episode review and discuss season 11, episode 22 of The Curse of Oak Island called Abbey Road. Unfortunately, we did not hear Come Together or Maxwell's Silver Hammer, but, you know, that is what it is. I'm a real Beatle fan, if you didn't know that. Always have been. But I digress. This is a great episode. I'm gonna go after a lot of the information on here. It's going to sound negative. I love this episode. I'm all in for this stuff. And you'll hear what I mean as we get through. Most of the episode actually took place in Europe. But we do have a couple of spots on Oak Island to talk about. So let's start there. And we could start with the Money Pit area, where we see Marty Lagina and Steve Guptill joined by Dr. Spooner. I believe Terry Matheson was there, too. And they're discussing what they're going to do with the remainder of their time on the island before winter sets in. And you have to say, man, when you see this conversation, the guys look pretty dejected here, and for good reason. The Garden Shaft project was supposed to be the project of the year, the one that enabled them to really search underground in the Money Pit for the first time. But alas, like every other searcher before them, flooding turned that dream into a nightmare. Tough stuff. Anyway, team has decided to turn their attention to an exploratory core drilling project in the Baby Blob area of the Money Pit to try and further trace the origin of precious metals found, the content of precious metals found in the water samples that are a few years old now, and we still haven't found an answer to what that stuff is. So it's a good project. It helps them for this year, collect some more data. I like it. That's all we really get here about the Money Pit. I mean, later, we see a quick scene where we get Terry and now joined by Charles Barkhouse as they're sort of starting the project off. It looks from the previews for next week, we're going to get some more, but it's pretty clear the season is almost done. That's one of the big takeaways here from this Money Pit this week. Now let's jog over to Lot 5, where we see the archaeologists, so it's Laird Niven, Helen Sheldon, and Moya MacDonald, working at the stone foundation there. Moya pulls out of the sifting tray where they sift through all the spoils of the digging. What Laird says is a metal button with what he calls a quote-unquote strange design on it. Laird looks genuinely intrigued by this piece throughout the entirety of the rest of these scenes involving this. And that always has me intrigued as well. So they bring this piece down to the lab for Emma Culligan to work her magic. And she does work magic for sure. Honestly, the most exciting thing we get here about this, after getting a rundown of what Emma found, is the confirmation, again, that Laird is indeed truly fascinated by this find. He calls it a lead-coated tin button and says it has a rising sun design on it, which is a lot clearer here after Emma cleaned it up and, you know, and got a better look at it. Laird also says it is unique in its chemical makeup. I would like to have heard a little bit more on this. What exactly is unique about it, and unique to what, right? Or we mean unique to Oak Island's finds, unique to Nova Scotia, unique to archaeology, you know what I mean? I was a bit confused by that, but maybe that's just a me thing. I'm not really sure. Laird also says he thinks it's very, very old, or at least it could be. So now, again, here's where I'm confused by the description by Laird of it being unique, because he apparently knows of some other buttons that he can compare this one to that kind of help him with the dating process. Now, that doesn't sound unique at all to me, right? Unique means one of a kind. It's either unique or it's not. But I'm pretty sure I'm nitpicking here, and I'm probably nitpicking at more of an editing choice and not really Laird's analysis of the item and its makeup. It's probably just the way they edited that word unique in. I would like to have seen some of these other buttons that he was comparing them to and maybe heard a little bit more about, you know, what these were and what they could have been used for. But we don't get that here. Maybe we will in the future. Sometimes we go back to these things. But again, just Laird's assessment that the button could date from the Middle Ages all the way up to the 1700s or so, coupled with the fact that he's so intrigued, is really kind of cool. Now, again, Middle Ages all the way up to the 1700s. The narration, of course, only focuses on the Middle Ages part of the story because that's the story du jour here, the theory du jour. Steve B. on the Patreon remarked, always the earliest date they focus on. And that's exactly right, Steve. We just kind of have to work our way through that, really. I don't think that's ever going to change. Again, Laird calls this button a game changer for the archaeological work on Lot 5. And that's Marty's words, game changer, but Laird seemed to agree, at least that's what it looked like. But regardless, again, Laird thinks this button could indicate the feature itself might be older than they originally suspected, and he's excited about that. Hopefully we get some more on the button soon. Okay, that's really all that happened at Oak Island this week. So let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, head to the other side of the Atlantic. It is time to hop an Alitalia flight to a place called Morimondo, which is in the north of Italy, not far from Milan. It is Rick Lagina, Alex Lagina, Peter Frenetti is there. So is Doug Kroll. And the team is there to meet with Emiliano Sacchetti, who is the researcher that we've seen a couple times. And, of course, Professor Gaspani. The man who formulated the 1200s Nolan Cross astro alignment theory that they've been talking about so much these past couple of weeks, which they first heard about in Italy last year. So the guys are here to see the Morimondo Abbey, a former Cistercian monastery, that was built between 1182 and 1296. Yes, you heard that right. Between money issues, political disputes, even some local violence and stuff, it took over a century to finish construction on this abbey. Before the guys start touring the abbey, Professor Gaspani comments that he believes Nolan's Cross was built by the Knights Templar or perhaps the Cistercians. So who and what are the Cistercians? We've talked a lot about the Templars, not about the Cistercians. Let me just start off by saying I'm not really an expert on this, but I can tell you with confidence that we are about to talk about an organization that actually is related to the Knights Templar. Both groups had the same man amongst its founders, the famous Bernard of Clairvaux, who was a highly regarded monk within the Catholic Church, who helped to found both the Knights Templar and the Cistercians. The Cistercians were founded about 20 years before the Templars. So there's an absolute and definitive connection here between the two organizations, unlike the many other groups the show likes to connect to the Templars without much evidence. But how closely they were connected in actuality and practice, hard to say, so let's back up a bit. Both organizations grew in popularity and power, and especially wealth, at about the same time. They shared a lot of the same traditions and rules as one would expect from two groups sharing a similar founder. But the Templars were knights, obviously. That means they were warriors. The Cistercians were not. They were monks. So though the two were related through their founding and maybe had a lot of relations in that manner, especially in the beginning of each of their histories, they were very, very separate, very, very different organizations with very different views on the world, and even with different views on Christianity and religion. The Cistercians were founded in France in 1098, and they pretty quickly spread throughout Christian Europe, much like the Templars. Now, there is a lot to say about them and their history, but again, I'm not an expert, so let me keep it simple. Part of their commitment to their faith was to live a certain way, and that's true of all monks, right? And one of the tenets of their monastic life was manual labor. Again, this is true for a lot of orders of monks, such as the Trappist monks, a once Cistercian sect of monks who put their labor to the holy and divine pursuit of farming the ingredients and brewing really good beer. But also, besides farming and other manual labor pursuits, the monks also built many things, the Cistercians specifically, many things all throughout Europe, like churches, abbeys, and monasteries. They got a lot of donations. They were very rich with property and all that kind of stuff. Again, kind of along the same lines as the Templars. The Cistercians also were big into other, what may be the right word now would be to call, technological pursuits, developing things and experimenting on things like hydraulics, engineering, irrigation, metallurgy. They're a fascinating organization and one definitely worth reading about for sure. But one thing they were not very into was killing, and that's a huge difference from their cousins, the Knights Templar. In fact, during the Crusades, some leaders of the Cistercian order openly questioned and objected to the idea of religious military orders, and even objected to the idea that those who died fighting in the name of Christianity or in the name of converting people to Christianity should perhaps not be considered martyrs. Specifically, a monk named Isaac of Stella, I think he was English, who called the Templars a quote-unquote new monstrosity for using violence to essentially convert Muslims to Christianity. This opinion, as you would imagine, was not at all popular in the Catholic world at the time, certainly during the Crusades, yet they were willing to speak out with this criticism nonetheless. So we can conclude that the Templars and the Cistercians were not always the best of buddies, but even so, there is a relationship there, a similarity in beliefs, traditions, and even maybe a similarity in their building techniques. So let's go back to Morimondo, Italy. Before the guys enter the abbey, Mr. Sacchetti points out these five designs on the facade of the building here, to which Doug points at a couple of them and calls them four-pointed crosses, which is related to something called the H.O. stone. It's a cross, a Templar sort of symmetrical cross with dots in the spaces in between all the crosses, or in between the arms of the cross. And they did a good job of describing the H.O. stone here for us and how it relates. And I've said this before, but I'm always a little dubious about the H.O. stone. No one can ever find out what it was or what it was used for, when it was carved, or even when it was carved and who might have done it, because the people who originally found it in the 20th century thought so much of it that they blew it up, dynamited it, thinking there might be treasure inside, which is not a really a very a story that makes a whole lot of sense, let's be honest. And then they apparently lost all the pieces, so we haven't been able to do any work on it. Anyway, whether the HO stone was real or not, these symbols Doug is looking at here don't really look much like four-pointed crosses to me. The designs are clearly not crosses. They're not even, you know, pointing in the right direction. And the dots there are not really dots. Maybe they look like they are from the ground, from the distance they're looking at, but the close-up we get here from the camera work makes it really pretty clear. But Doug does certainly have a good imagination, and we are always trying our best to tie in something to Oak Island, whether it's there or not, right? I mean, that's what they're going to look for. And like I say all the time, you know, you go out in the woods looking for Bigfoot, a lot of times you're going to find evidence of Bigfoot, whether Bigfoot's there or not. You go to a haunted house and somebody tells you it's haunted, something creepy is going to happen because that's what you're looking for, right? And that happens here too, I think, to some degree. The team then goes inside the Abbey to roam around a room called the Scriptorium. Now, I'm sure you've seen monks depicted in the Middle Ages. You know, I remember one in the Spaceship Earth ride at Epcot in Walt Disney World, where they're quietly toiling endlessly away at a desk, writing down all the knowledge and all the learning of their day. Well, they're doing that in a room called a Scriptorium. That's what it is. It's sort of a monk's study hall. It's not exactly a very exciting place, but an incredibly important place in the history of Western civilization, for sure. Sacchetti again shows them some symbols on the walls, equating them to the Templars and then therefore to Oak Island. There's not much here to expand upon for you guys, although Charlie and Michael in the live chat pointed out that one of the designs might have included leaves from oak trees. Now, that's a good spot, guys, but Merrily then asked if there are, in fact, oak trees in Europe, and I think the answer is yes. As far as I know, there are and there always have been. So it might be that we too here in the live chat are looking for a connection that really isn't there. And with that in mind, another comment on the live chat was from Ginger, who wrote, "This episode is nothing to talk about yet. So many assumptions about markings on things no one ever took a picture of, nor did they ever write it down." And listen, I agree. It's going to sound like I'm being very dismissive of all this stuff, or at least a lot of it. And maybe to some degree I am. But I absolutely love it. I just want to take the time to say that. In the long run, this all may amount to nothing involving Oak Island, but this kind of history is what I am here for. Sometimes I wish they would give this kind of treatment to the history of the dig as well and really dive into that for everybody. Now, before the show went to a commercial, the narrator says something really cool here. Something we don't like to talk about, something we don't hear talked about a lot, but I just wanted to make a mention of it. Because again, this history, this theory, this is what I'm here for. He says, quote, "Some believe the true reason for the Templar persecution was for the Catholic Church to confiscate the religious treasures that they possessed, which may have included the Ark of the Covenant," end quote. Now, usually you hear that the persecution occurred because the French king wanted to absolve his incredible debts he had with the Templars who helped him fund his wars in England. But this theory here, though active, is a little less popular because the Temples were under, the reason why it's less popular is because the Templars were under the direct control of the Pope throughout their existence. They reported only to the Vatican and not to any monarchs, not to any of any of the lands they resided in. So if they had a castle or a commandery, as they called them, in France, they didn't report to the French king. They didn't take orders from the French king. They only took their orders from the Pope. Why would the Vatican need to round them all up in order to confiscate the treasures when they could have just ordered them to turn the treasures and the relics over to the Vatican right after they found them? Why in the world would they have kept these treasures secret from the Pope, especially in the early 1100s, which is when we think that all happened? Again, that's the reason why it's not popular theory of what the Templars were doing here or what the real reason behind the persecution of the Templars was, but it's a cool theory. I thought I just might mention it for you. The narrator ends this segment by saying, quote, "Much of the Templar treasure has never been found." And just to clarify, folks, although I doubt I need to do that for you, but let me just make a little clearer that, in fact, when it comes to holy relics and the things that we talk on this show so much about, none of the Templar treasure has ever been found. Zero. The idea that the Knights Templar were in possession of sacred and ancient holy relics like the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail or the menorah or those kind of things is only a theory, and one with very little concrete evidence to support it. No documentation, no nothing. But just so I don't raise the ire of my theorist friends, I will admit that there is quite a lot of circumstantial evidence, of reasonable speculation, along with a large dollop of rumor, that such a treasure did exist and that the Templars found at least some of it when they dug under the tunnels or through the tunnels under Jerusalem. And really, I'm just saying that so Corian Wall doesn't start yelling at me. So anyway, let's take a quick break and come back here before we head to the Alps. The team next finds themselves further north in Italy, in the foothills of the Alps, about 30 miles or so from the border of Switzerland, in a town called Bianzano. I love saying that. They're there to look at a castle, which is actually called Suardi Castle. Weirdly, the show never uses that name, opting instead to call it the Bianzano Castle. I'm not sure why they decided to do that, but whatever. Now, my investigative bells started ringing really hard right off this bat here when the start of the scene. The narrator describes the castle by saying, dating back to the 13th century, Bianzano Castle is believed by many religious scholars to have once served as the Italian headquarters for the Order of the Knights Templar. It is also believed by some to have been one of the places where the Knights Templar may have safeguarded their treasures as they worked to transport them across Europe and finally to North America. Now, this quote is followed by an exchange with Professor Gaspani, who's there with them, who says, quote, "Whoever designed this castle belongs to the same cultural environment as the one who placed Nolan's Cross on Oak Island." Doug then asks, "And the Templars built this castle?" To which Gaspani responds, "Yes, as we know in all probability that this one was Templar." So you can see my confusion here, right, with all this. First, the words are things like "believed by many" and "whoever designed this castle." But somehow we get right to, "Yes, the Templars built it." And the thing is, the confusion is not entirely the fault of the editing or the fault of Gaspani or Doug or any of these things, because the fact is the castle is somewhat mysterious in its origin. What leads some to conclude that the Templars might have built it is exactly the same kind of things that Gaspani uses here to relate the castle to Oak Island, symbols on the wall that look Templar. But no one really knows for sure, and here is where my brain goes. The Knights Templar in 1234, when this was apparently built, were at the height of their power and influence. Now, I say apparently built because there is a stone that has that date on it. Nobody has any actual knowledge of when this was finished, but there's a stone there that says that, so we're assuming that's when it was built. Anyway, the Templars at that time were at the height of their power and especially of their influence. They were the bankers to kings, and they were very popular throughout Europe. Now, there were a lot of people who didn't like some of the things the Templars were doing, but everybody knew who they were. They were a big deal. They were by no means, and it's important to know this, they were by no means a secret society. Everyone knew who the Templars were. So if they built this castle, wouldn't everyone have known that? I mean, I don't know. It seems like a lot is left out here in the story. And maybe some assumptions are being made based on a little bit of evidence. Anyway, Gaspani says, quote, "Whoever designed the castle belongs to the same cultural environment as the one who placed Nolan's Cross on Oak Island," end quote. And he believes this because he claims the castle was built using the same astronomical alignment that was used to place the boulders of Nolan's Cross. Now, honestly, the show doesn't do a very good job of explaining those similarities. And of course, no one here discusses or questions why this alignment would be used in the first place to build these things, or if any other sites that the Templars built or the Cistercians built also use the same alignment, or what it could mean for either site to have this alignment. What's the purpose of it? But I have to say it's pretty cool. Again, I really love this stuff, and I love the process of questioning it and thinking about it. That's what I'm here for. So let me say it like this. Even if you believe Fred Nolan created the cross himself, as many folks do, smarter folks than I, please, much smarter folks than I, then we got to conclude in that Nolan too used this same alignment involving these same stars and constellations in order to place his boulders, if we're to believe that Professor Gaspani's calculations here are perfectly accurate. There is no way for us to know that. We're just given some visuals on a show. We're not actually given any mathematics or any kind of indication of proof of anything, just his opinion, and we're relying on that. He's an expert. I'm willing to rely on that. But if you believe that that's true and these two things match, then we have to ask the questions on both sides, right? We have to ask, did Fred Nolan use these very same alignments, these very same stars and constellations in order to place his boulders? Do we know that Fred Nolan was at all aware of these alignments, or that this was an alignment that the Templars might have been interested in? And more, if he was in fact faking the cross, was he someone who wanted to convince the world of a Templar theory? Meaning, would he be motivated to create a Templar connection like this and go through the process of researching and executing these alignments? Well, it appears the answer might be yes, you know. You need to look any further than the History Channel's own website, which has an article called The Top 21 Theories About Oak Island. And one of those theories, which is called the Nolan Theory, is described thusly. It says, Fred Nolan, who explored the island and its mysteries for a few decades, beginning in the 1950s, believed the man-made carvings and other markings on the island formed a perfectly symmetrical cross believed to have originated with the Knights Templar, the Christian warrior monks who amassed huge wealth while living as bankers to Europe's most powerful medieval kings. Again, this is not to say that I believe Nolan fabricated the cross, because as far as I know, Fred actually never revealed any alignment theory. So why would he do all that, create this alignment, and just hope that maybe someone in the future figured the alignment out? But like I said, there are smarter folks than me who think the cross is a fabrication, and I'll let them speak for themselves. I'm not going to go any further into that. All I'm saying is, if these alignments are known to be a Templar thing, it makes sense that if you were trying to fabricate something to make it look Templar, then this would be a good place to base your fabrication and a great detail to add to the legitimacy of the ruse. But boy, it really is stretching the idea here that Nolan used these kind of alignments to make this cross. So are we saying it's just a coincidence? I don't really know. Again, this is really a long way of me saying I really wish they told us more about this when they did on the show here, so let's just move on. The guys next head inside the castle and see more symbols that look Templar in origin. Doug Kroll points out one on the wall, which he calls an eight-pointed star, and compares it to one found on a stone in Nova Scotia. Now, my wife and I were watching this. Now, my wife usually doesn't watch the show, but she happened to be sitting here with me watching it at this moment. I don't know why, but she was probably waiting for it to end so she can put on a Pirates game or something. And we're sitting there looking at it, and we can't figure out why it looks familiar to us. That was until Claude, on the Patreon live chat, made us both burst out laughing by writing, quote, "My grandma had that star design on quilts she made. Does that mean my grandma was a Templar?" So after cleaning the drink Claude made me spit out after reading that, I realized that we too have a quilt that looks a lot like that. Claude, I think I speak for all of us on the chat when I say, man, we love you. That was absolutely fantastic. The footage in Bianzano concludes with Professor Gaspani showing them a device he built called an avatar, which is related to the Cremona document, which is related to the Zena Halperin stuff. It could have been something, it's described in those documents, it could have been something that was an old navigation device and might have been able to double as an architectural aid. It's kind of cool stuff, not much here to discuss for us. So it's time to take one more break, and then we can come back and head up to Holland. Now, I like to imagine the team hopping one of those European trains filled with backpacking Americans and all on gap years, right? taking selfies with adoring fans and standing in line at the bar car as they ride the rails from Italy to the Netherlands, where they meet Corey and Maul in a town called Maastricht, which is by the Belgian border of the Netherlands. Corian is joined by another historian, a man named Jaco Silverton, who has a great Indiana Jones-style hat, man. He had the whole sort of Indiana Jones vibe going, really, if I'm honest. The sort of Josh Gates Indiana Jones thing. They're here to tour a quarry that was built by, and I'm starting to sound like a broken record here, but according to Silverton, built by people, quote, that may have had a connection to the Knights Templar. It's called the Caster Stone Quarry, and it actually might date back as a quarry to the Roman era, but it was specifically what they're talking about here, used between the 12th and 16th centuries as a source of limestone for building things like churches and monasteries. It's an amazing labyrinth of huge tunnels and big underground open spaces. Corian shows them some markings high up on the walls that, again, resemble some of the Templar symbols like the menorah, cross, and that kind of thing. The idea here is that this might have been a stop on their route out of Europe as they were fleeing arrest and hurrying their precious relics to a safe hiding place, presumably on Oak Island. I'm not sure why, if you're a fugitive running from the law, you would put marks all over the hiding places that you had so the pursuers would know for certain you were there. But I'm going to get to that in a minute. I get it. We're going to get to that in just a second. Everything we see here, again, is very, very cool. I absolutely love this stuff. I'm not seeing any definitive connection to Oak Island here, but I'm here for it 100% because what I'm seeing is Corian following the trail of the Templars. Whether that leads to Oak Island, I don't know. But we're following the trail of the Templars, something he's been doing quite a lot of research, great research on. But why is this important, right? If this proves that the Templars were here in Holland, in the Netherlands, like I said, it doesn't prove anything with regards to Oak Island. So why are we seeing this? Why is it important? It was hard to really know from the show. But a few hours later, Corian sent me an email, which I think you guys are going to love to hear. He writes, "During the European research for this series, we found two underground locations on the Dutch-Belgian border. One is located under the castle ruins of Valkenburg, the Netherlands, and the other under the plateau of Kastert near the city of Maastricht. Yeah. In both chambers, we have found large amounts of inscriptions and drawings that we suspect were left behind by the Knights Templar. Why do we think Dutch discoveries have anything to do with the Knights Templar? We have found a large number of unique symbols in both underground spaces that individually and in combination are similar and often identical to iconography in places like Italy, Portugal, and France, where the Knights Templar are known to have been imprisoned or sheltered in the 14th century. The spaces we found date from the same period. The tunnels in Kastert that you saw on last night's show were 40 feet high and have been dated to the 14th century from the way they were cut out. Block breakers worked their way into the mountain and then down using large iron sticks to chisel out the blocks of marlstone. The drawings were made of soot by holding a candle or oil lamp to the ceiling, producing a black dot. The drawings you saw took months to make. Samples of it have been dated to the 14th century by a team from a Dutch university. The symbol of an elongated lily with the cross at the end of its stems that you saw on the show is identical to the medieval sign or symbol signature from the Templar Lord from the south of France that we have found back on a notary document from December of 1307, just months after their arrests. Around the corner from this section, we found the coat of arms of a bishop that was only in service for 2 years, in the period not too long after the arrests. So we can say with high confidence that this is the 14th century. It all adds up. Next, I compared the symbols to known Templar sites that we have visited, like Tamar, Viterbo, Dom, and others like Chinon in France. I don't think I'm saying that right, but that's the best I can do. There is a huge overlap across some 20 symbols that weren't ordinarily symbols, but things sometimes exclusively used by the Templars in that period, like the four-dot cross, the triple enclosure, the chessboard patterns, the crossbow with the implements. We have found literal copies of some of the symbols on Templar tombstones in Tamar. This is a very exciting discovery indeed. Mind you, this is an area where there aren't supposed to be any Templars at all. They didn't have any confirmed presence in this area. You haven't seen the best stuff yet. Happy to discuss after next week, Corian. I got to tell you guys, this is why Corian wrote a great book. He really knows how to keep you hanging on in all this. And then he just hits you with this bombshell at the end, right? This entire time I'm watching this scene, I'm thinking to myself, why are we looking at this one particular site? There are Templar sites all over Europe. Why this one? Why is this one of such importance to us? And this is why we love Corian, because the show managed to kind of skip over or glance over the incredibly important fact that Corian hit us with. Quote, this is an area where there aren't supposed to be any Templars at all. Now we've got something, right? What were they doing here? Why would they be in a quarry? Now, again, I love this kind of thing. I understand those who don't understand the connection to Oak Island, but what Corian is doing here is looking for clues of the Templars fleeing Europe after their persecution. And we might actually have quite a clue here. Again, this is great stuff, but it is my job to ask some questions, and I've mentioned them before already, but I'm going to do it again here. Why, on God's green earth, would someone running from for their lives, a fugitive on the run, hiding from the law, why would they have ever purposely left behind proof of their presence in their hideout? Why would they make it perfectly clear to essentially their pursuers that their pursuers are indeed on the right trail? And that's what you've done by making these marks on here. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. By leaving these carvings and images behind, they're essentially leaving breadcrumbs for the authorities chasing them. And really, really bad and obvious breadcrumbs. It makes sense in a jail when they've already been caught, but not in a place where they might be on the run. It's the equivalent of a fugitive cowboy being chased by a posse, purposely leaving behind his hat that he wrote his name on. It doesn't make any sense at all. And also, the timeline isn't working here. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with Corian Maul or Chris Morford. But the timeline that they're giving us here isn't jiving with what's being presented to us in other parts of Oak Island. Chris and Corian are talking about a scenario where the Templars are on the run after the King of France declared them heretics and ordered them all to be arrested. That happened in 1307, which is decidedly not 1200 or even 1250, like Gaspani is saying, when the cross was built. And also the dating in the swamps and all these kind of things. We're looking for clues of the Templars' escape from Europe. But the clues we're talking about on Oak Island are from decades before that escape. But I'm going to hold off on this line of questioning anymore. And I'm going to do so because of that other cliff that Corian kept us hanging on when he said, quote, you haven't seen the best stuff yet. That's going to do it, folks, for this episode of the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Don't forget, you can really help out the show by becoming a patron. If you think the show is worth $5 a month to you, head over to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. And if you prefer, you can also make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username @DaveMcBrideMusic. Also, if you'd like to help out the show in another way, then you could do so by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your shows. Thanks to everybody who's done that. I really appreciate you taking the time to do so. You can also follow the show on Facebook. Just put @DigginOakIsland into your search bar. We've got some cool stuff on there sent in from listeners over the past few weeks. And if you have any questions or comments or things you want to send to me, you could do that directly via email at digginoakisland@gmail.com. Just keep in mind, if you do send me an email, or even if you happen to choose to direct message me on social media, which sometimes I don't get to, folks, so email is the easiest one. Just remember, I may answer your questions or talk about your theories or anything like that here on the podcast. So if for any reason you don't want your message read, just make a note of that and I'll do my best to answer you directly. Well, folks, it's crown time. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.